With that, we'll call the first case of the morning, number 0831168, U.S. v. Miller. We'll hear from Mr. Stroud.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a case about Dr. Miller. I'm not going to go over the facts. I'm sure the court has reviewed the facts. I'll briefly state that he was a doctor practicing in Zawali, Louisiana, which is down in Sabine Parish. He was a doctor down there from approximately 1986 to 2004. In 1999, he entered into a contract with DeSoto General. That contract was terminated in 2002. In January 2003, he was arrested for theft on a state charge, which is still pending. And approximately two years later, he was indicted on two counts for tax evasion.
State charge is pending 6 years later?
Yes, ma'am.
Good grief.
The issue that the way I would like to treat this, and of course subject to your Honor's questions, is that I'd like to start with the two issues that I think are key to the case and really drive the resolution of issues three and four. The first is the exclusion of the mediation between Dr. Miller and the DeSoto General held in December 2002. I start with the proposition that under Davis versus Alaska, that an accused has a right to present a defense, which includes the effective cross-examination of witnesses. This was indeed set forth again in Chambers versus Mississippi, where the court stated that the denial of significant diminution of the right to cross-examination calls into question the ultimate integrity of the fact-finding process and requires that the competing interests be closely examined.
Why was that settlement agreement relevant in the case before us?
Yes. The first thing, and it would start, Judge Garza, that Dr. Miller was accused of evading taxes on money he embezzled. That was the government's, in fact, the government alleged in the indictment that one of the acts of evasion was embezzlement. It's my position, Judge, that the jury heard nothing about the civil dispute between DeSoto and Dr. Miller. From the defendant's perspective, defending against the charge that your client not only is a tax cheat, he's a thief.
Let's stop right there. I just want to make sure that I understand what went before the jury. The jury only received a tax evasion instruction. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Two counts.
Yes, sir.
Not that he was a thief.
No, sir.
And any evidence of that would have probably been instructed out through our regular pattern jury charge that says any other bad acts. But I presume that was given. Is that correct?
Sir. It was, Judge.
So let's go back. How does, and as I understand, the mediation agreement was for payment of wages that DeSoto may have owed Dr. Miller.
Correct.
Now, how is that relevant to the tax evasion? Give us your best argument, because it seems to me that this may be an interesting point, but I don't think you've proved that it's relevant. Or that, put it another way, that the district court abused its discretion in excluding this evidence.
Ron Wolf, the CEO of DeSoto, testified that he discovered the embezzlement the first day he took office in January of 2003. He was allowed to testify to that during his testimony. We were not able to counter that argument. We were not able to show that, well, wait a minute, that's the allegation of DeSoto. But in December of 2002, there was a negotiation. We thought we had a settlement agreement. True, it wasn't approved, but the parties made a good faith, said that they would make a good faith effort to recommend this approval to the board or to the management. Management changed. The act of evasion was, the government argued that one of the acts of evasion was theft. We were not allowed to show such things as the situation leading up to the negotiations. Dr. Miller's complaint against DeSoto, and he had several complaints. Both sides had complaints, Judge. Indeed, in the proposed receipt and release, there was, I refer the court to our proffer number, I believe it's number 7, the first page. It states, appears to hereby release, acquit, discharge, and covenant to indemnify and hold each other, harmless each other and the other principals, agents, and employees against and from any and all actions, causes of actions, claims, demands, specific performance, damages, costs, loss of services, expenses, penalties, attorney's fees, and compensation occurring prior to December 16, 2002, which was exactly part of the issue in the income tax case.
But the core of his non-payment of taxes or evasion was his participation with Save a Patriot. So what is it you wanted to argue to the jury relative to the settlement that would have been probative to the jury about the tax evasion piece?
Well, I think, Judge Stewart, it was probative of the tax evasion because, again, the government alleged this as an act of evasion, that this theft was an act of evasion. We wanted to put on testimony about what Dr. Miller did. We had nothing to rebut that argument. I still maintain, and maybe it's my inability to get you to home plate, but I believe that that was a key to the case. The two keys, the other one dealt with the marital privilege, which I'll get to in a minute. When the government gets up and says, well, and this was part of the argument on willful blindness, which is that this guy committed theft and he's up here saying that he didn't know or he was trying to, that he did not have the specific intent to defraud when he was paying taxes. Well,
if he had to, there's something in here about two sets of invoices with DeSoto.
There was.
And if that were true, then that would be evidence of evasion, wouldn't it, irrespective of whether he had accounted properly to DeSoto and so on?
I agree with that, Your Honor. However, even though there was no testimony that I remember that Dr. Miller treated those funds separately. He had no bank accounts. They cashed the checks, and he took out money orders. And he didn't segregate that which he got from DeSoto and treated that differently from his other income. Granted, he did not, these issues were basically stipulated. He didn't file a tax return. Under the law, he was required to file a tax return. So the only issue in this case, in reality, was intent, specific intent and knowledge. Once you allow this theft evidence in without any ability of the defendant to put it in context.
Well, no doubt it's the classic red herring argument, but even if it were erroneously admitted, why do you think that turned the jury? I don't see how that was fatally prejudicial, such that we have to reverse the verdict.
Yes, ma'am. And I understand that the burden is on us to show an abuse of discretion by the trial judge. But again, when this uncontested, basically, evidence that he committed theft was an element that went to the willfulness, I believe, and the argument that I would have made if I was the government. Here's a guy that was taking money, and the reason he didn't file a return is that he didn't want to show any, he didn't want his tracks followed. It wasn't, and that's an act of evasion. I mean, and it's clearly set forth in the indictment. I believe, first of all, I believe that under 408, that evidence of negotiation is relevant in a criminal case. I've cited cases that went both ways. I believe this court has previously held in a case decided by the government that 408 does not apply in a criminal case, but you still have Section B of 408. In one of the cases cited by the government, negotiations in a mediation were admitted to show that the defendant had committed the crime. The government's, I mean, the court had no problem with that when the defense objected. What I think and what I believe and what is that on this issue of willfulness and knowledge, the defense should have had the opportunity to present this, the whole issue of the negotiations, because they were running side by side. In December 2002, there was negotiations. There were negotiations. In fact, there was preliminary approval of those negotiations. In January 2003, after Dr. Miller had given notice of termination of the lease, a new CEO, Mr. Wolf, is hired. And Mr. Wolf says on the first day he discovered the embezzlement and said, hey, we need to stop this. If we had been able to get into the situation around the negotiations, we would have shown, I believe, that those documents certainly weren't generated after the agreement. Those documents were available in December of 2002. Those documents were available to the CEO and everybody else during the negotiations.
The government raises a 403 argument. Tell me why the court erred in finding that the probative weight was substantially overweight any prejudice.
I start out, Judge Garza, with acknowledgement that the rule is that the trial judge obviously has broad discretion. I don't argue that at all. I do believe, however, that there is some limit to that. In this particular case, I think in analyzing what was going on here, you get into situations of the right to present a defense. I believe this was part of our right to present a defense. And as I say in my brief, I can see the point. If we had put it on and the jury may nevertheless have come back with the same verdict, we don't know. But I think these negotiations were so crucial and so tied into what was going on the tax situation that I believe that, with all due respect to Judge Hicks, he's a good trial judge, but I think in this instance, the refusal to allow us to go into those negotiations with our witnesses as we proffered took those facts off the board, so that the jury really didn't have everything before it that it could have. And I believe in that particular situation, of course, I will also concede that if the court finds that this did not fall within the defendant's right, then you're correct, and the ruling should stand. But
stripped of that argument, then what was your defense case? I know the piece of the wife's testimony, so was the rest of the defense case the documents? Because Dr. Miller didn't testify, right?
Dr. Miller did testify.
Did testify.
Yes, sir.
All right, so that would have been a line of inquiry you would have been going through with him vis-a-vis this agreement?
Yes, sir. And right, so I believe.
My question is, absent that evidence, what essentially was your argument to the jury in the face of the remaining charge, since you didn't get the settlement?
And we didn't get the marital. Well, we had a problem with that, too, but I'll get to that in a minute. The argument basically was the classic Cheek versus U.S. argument Dr. Miller had a reasonable, good faith belief that his actions were proper. The question is not what you as a third party believe is objective, but whether or not you believe that Dr. Miller held that opinion. I think it's a classic.
Do you know of any tax protester who's ever gotten off on that theory?
No, ma'am.
That's the problem, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am. But again, and I want to say that I was, my part in the case dealt with the evidentiary issues. And I'm not trying to make excuses. It's the first case I was back after being sick. Another attorney handled the case. And I don't agree with the position. I pay my taxes.
Right, we understand.
But I do believe a citizen has a right to present a defense, and we were trying to present this defense. If we had had our facts in front of the jury, and the jury would have returned the same verdict, and they may very well have. Again, we wouldn't, I mean, that argument would be off the board.
Now, on both of those issues, the exclusion and the inclusion issues, we still, if we find for you in each one, we still have to go through a harmless error standard. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So, I think you've already explained pretty much the prejudice part of it.
The marital privilege, and the problem with that is that the government out of the blue asked Mrs. Miller, "Did you have the intent to violate the tax laws?" There was an objection. I think this is her intent was irrelevant. I simply don't believe, other than to show guilt by association. She merely said that my husband wasn't going to pay taxes. I told him we ought to pay. He didn't listen to me. And then she gets on the stand and testifies, "Well, I knew I had an obligation, but I didn't do anything." And the judge found that was sufficient to waive the marital privilege, and I'm out of time.
All right. You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Cossier.
Good morning, Your Honors. I would just like to mention that defendant did raise four issues in his opening brief, and in his reply brief, he mentions those three and then adds another one that is different. His fourth issue in his opening brief was sufficiency of the evidence. His final issue that he addresses in his reply brief raises for the first time the issue of the cumulative effect of the errors that he alleged in the first three issues. And I just thought I would note that for the court, that this is the first time, that was the first time he raised that particular issue. With respect to the settlement negotiations, the district judge heard a great deal of argument. There were written memoranda filed on the issue. And the judge ruled in the transcript, it's at pages 3 to 6, regarding the admissibility of the settlement and compromise negotiations. And the judge found first they were not relevant to determine defendant's intent with respect to the tax cases. They weren't relevant to determine intent at all, because settlement negotiations that took place in December really related to the contract and the differences in the payment. And it's perhaps not elaborated a great deal in the briefs, but there were two separate contracts.
He was on a salary?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that dispute was his salary as opposed to what he owed the hospital?
What happened was the initial contract said his salary would be $130,000, and that contract was given to payroll, and they paid him according to that initial contract. They never got the second contract, which was retroactive to the first day of the agreement, that upped his salary to $145,000. So that made a difference in the amount of money that he should have been paid, a considerable difference. Plus, defendant had in the contract, he received 90% of the profits over and above all of the expenses of the clinic. Well, if his salary was only $130,000, the likelihood of there being a profit was greater than if his salary was $145,000. And so there had to be some recalculations. The payroll department did not get the second contract until, I believe it was May of 2002. The contract was effective all through 2000, all through 2001. And so it had been a considerable period of time that he was paid incorrectly. Then began the negotiations with respect to his past compensation only. And that's what the board or the negotiations were about.
Well, the jury didn't, but that was excluded.
Right, that was all excluded, but that was what the judge knew.
Why is the idea of the theft relevant?
The idea of the theft is really not relevant, except the fact that he was getting more money than was actually reported, because the DeSoto Regional was deducting or withholding income taxes from his salary and his profit sharing, whereas the other amount of money that was not going through DeSoto Regional that he was embezzling, the theft, he was getting that in cash.
Well, now, let's two questions on that. Number one, according to Mr. Stroud, it was Dr. Wolf that first noticed this, quote, embezzling, and it was related to the wages, the contract, and all of this. So the question then is, why shouldn't that come in? That's number one. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Dr. Wolf came on after the negotiations regarding the compensation, the salary, and the profit sharing. He came on in January.
So it's a totally different.
It is a completely different thing. The Dr. Wolf did go through the contract. I don't think he's a doctor. Mr. Wolf did go through the contract and determined that defendant should not be withholding the accident claims is what he was doing, the cases that involved accidents.
Did the government use the evidence that he embezzled or that he committed theft from that episode to show that there was tax evasion?
That is correct. They showed that they used that to show that he had additional income that was not reported anywhere and that there was no withholding on it, and he was taking actions to evade the reporting of that additional money.
Now, that being the case, why shouldn't that evidence have come in?
It should not have come in because
the settlement, that is.
The settlement should not have come in because it had nothing to do with the monies that he was keeping himself and keeping a double set of books on in his medical manager program at his office. That money wasn't even coming through DeSoto Regional.
So the settlement itself did not impinge in any way on this double set of books or this extra money that he was receiving and not disclosing to the government, as opposed to taking from the hospital?
That is correct. It had nothing to do. That was simply a matter of the contractual relationship between DeSoto Regional and defendant. In January, when Mr. Wolf came on and he discovered that DeSoto Regional should have been receiving more money, Wolf went out to the clinic and saw the huge number of people who were there and asked one of the employees there, on average, how many patients do you see a day? And he was told around 45 to 50 some days, and went back to the DeSoto Regional office and found out how many people were being reported as patients on average a day. A top day would be about 33 or 34. Big difference. And that was one thing that turned him to look at this. And then there was the erroneous paperwork that had come through DeSoto Regional that one of the billing clerks had found and called to Mr. Wolf's attention. And that's when they became aware that something wasn't quite right out there. The other thing, the settlement negotiations in December strictly related to the two contracts and the payments that had been made under those contracts with respect to salary and profit.
Was showing that Dr. Miller had this cash money he was receiving that wasn't subject to withholding, was that designed by the government to negate his good faith tax protester defense, so to speak? In other words, if he's defending the case based on I had a good faith defense as, you know, a tax, well, not as a tax protester, whatever you call it, conscientious objector to paying taxes, was showing the government's effort in showing, well, he's got this wad of money over here, this cash that he's getting, it's not subject to withholding, then surely that pierces any notion that this other money over here that he's withholding is not part of a good faith tax protester.
Well, Your Honor, that evidence really went for two different purposes. The amount of money that he was collecting was related to determining what his income actually was, how much money was he receiving, and what then would his taxable income be, and what would be the amount of taxes he owed on it. So it was for the purpose of determining the tax deficiency, which is one of the elements of the offense.
There just has to be a deficiency, right?
I'm sorry?
There just has to be a deficiency.
Yes, Your Honor, there has to be a deficiency.
And he was charged with the court found a restitution obligation based on the amount that of taxes he owed, right?
Your Honor, I don't know about the restitution, but I know that the jury was presented with evidence of this is how much we have calculated he received and what his total taxable income was. This is what was withheld. These are the taxes he paid, and this is how much more he owed.
But that's not the liquidating that amount is not normally an element of the offense, is it? In other words, you don't have to show a dispute about embezzlement in order to show that he did not file a tax form, that he was had a prosperous clinic, and therefore
you just have to show that he did not pay taxes, and he took efforts to evade the payment of those taxes.
And this case is not—it's not based on failing to file a tax form. It's failing to pay the taxes. The evading of taxes.
He attempted to evade the payment of taxes, and he did not file an income tax return at all.
I understand that, but that's not part of the liability, the criminal liability elements.
The element is the tax deficiency, the failure to pay, and the evasive actions taken to avoid the payment of the tax.
Okay.
That's correct. With respect to the settlement negotiations, one thing that really makes them much less relevant is that defendant failed to file income tax returns from 1996 through up to the time that he became affiliated with DeSoto Regional. So the relevance of the settlement negotiations plummets when you think in terms of, well, he wasn't doing this anyway, so what relevance does this have to do with his intent at all?
Ms. Garcia, let me ask you one thing about this piece of evidence. Is this undisputed that he never consulted an attorney or CPA during this period to verify his understanding of the tax law?
He did not.
That's undisputed.
He said that. He testified to that on cross-examination. He acknowledged that he did not consult with anyone. He consulted with Kottmeyer, the Save a Patriot information. He did self-study. He read the Supreme Court cases, none later than 1957. And this was all his self-study. Previous to 1996, he had employed CPAs to file his tax returns and had followed their advice. After that, he did not consult with anyone.
That was 1996. When he started
was his right. That's when he stopped filing.
He didn't appeal the award of restitution to DeSoto, did he?
Your Honor, there's no reference to restitution at all here.
Why don't you move on to the marital privilege here?
The marital privilege is there was very little that she actually said, but it should be noted that his former wife was also a registered nurse in his office. She was his bookkeeper in his office. She was his office administrator. So she had many duties within the office and then, of course, personal aspects at home. She was probably always around her husband. And these discussions that she mentioned that they had with regard to filing taxes or not filing taxes was an ongoing discussion, as she testified to it, took place some at the office, some at home.
Well, you know, I don't think the marital privilege is waived because you're in business with your spouse.
That may be correct, but she was, in fact, that is correct. The problem with that is, though, that the discussions were with regard to not filing income tax returns, and that was what she disagreed with him on, and she said she disagreed with him, and so that was their discussion. She testified mostly to observations. She observed that he received...
But that's a very damning type of evidence, as you can imagine, it seems to me. So why does it fall outside the marital privilege?
Because they were together in the not filing income tax returns. She could have filed independently. And the one comment that defendant really found most offensive is that she believed she was not, she was breaking the law. She was doing something illegal by not filing an income tax return.
So you're saying that this comes in through the hearsay exception, the conspiracy, criminal conspiracy hearsay exception?
It comes in through the exception of, for the marital privilege of the spouses being involved in joint criminal conduct, because they were not filing. They had filed jointly before. They
and
were not
is,
filing
And this
together.
Is her privilege, not his privilege.
It was his privilege to keep her from making the statements.
But it's her privilege to urge it. He can't urge it for her, can he?
Yes.
Yes, he's the one who wanted to keep her from testifying.
No, but what I'm saying is it's the witness's privilege. In other words, the witness can testify if she wants or not. I mean, of course she has the argument.
Yeah, but there are two different aspects to the marital privilege. There's the one that the witness has while the marriage is intact, that she could not be forced to testify, and she could not be prohibited from testifying.
That's
it is
right.
Her privilege. The second privilege is the one regarding confidential communications during the marriage, regardless of whether the marriage is intact. Remember, they were divorced in 2003.
Sure.
So these communications occurred during the time the marriage was intact, and that's what defendant did not want her to testify to these communications, because he said they were confidential communications between the spouses. And there is that second aspect to the privilege.
Now, that's the 803 objection.
There was a 408 objection. But the 408 was settlement. No, there was no, I don't recall an 803 objection at all.
But you're relying on, the government's relying on sustaining the trial judge here on the basis of the joint conspiracy exception.
Correct.
I'm not sure that that's what he ruled on.
That is exactly the way the district judge ruled. Right. He ruled that this was joint criminal conduct, that it need not be alleged as a conspiracy. She need not be charged as a conspirator or even as a co-defendant.
All right, well, what's the showing? I tried to figure it out in looking at some of the cases. What's the showing you, meaning the government, have to make in terms of, it's clear about what's being alleged about him, but as relates to her, do you have to make the contours of this joint, quote, criminal conduct? Obviously, she's not charged
right, as
he is. So what are the contours the government has to satisfy? I mean, is it enough to say, well, it's his wife, and they filed joint returns? I mean, what's the contours of hooking it under that exception of joint criminal conduct, A, where there's no requirement that she be charged in indictment, but what do you have to show? Just showing she's married to him is enough?
Well, they did not file any income tax return at all from 1996 through 2002, I believe.
So if you show she did not take any independent or separate actions of her own, that's enough for the government to satisfy?
But she attempted on one occasion to do that, and there is testimony to that effect, and he became angry with her for attempting to file in, I think it was 1999, that she testified that she attempted to file herself individually rather than with her husband jointly, and he became angry. She testified that she believed she was violating the law by not filing. She did not testify because she did testify that he had the Save a Patriot information and had gotten all of that and had talked with this one gentleman who was selling medical equipment about he did not have the right to, did not have to file income taxes or file income tax returns or pay taxes, I should say. But the district judge's findings with respect to both the spousal privilege and the settlement agreement, the spousal privilege had a lengthy discussion, and I thought I had those page numbers noted here, and I do not, but they are noted in the brief.
All right.
Are there any other questions or issues?
No, ma'am.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Mr. Stroud.
Judge Jones, one of your questions, I mean, really has nothing to do with this case, but you asked me, had I ever heard of an individual who had been acquitted, a tax protester? Well, one, about 3 months earlier, one had been acquitted in Shreveport with the same attorney, and that's the only case I know.
Who was the lawyer?
Mr. Beecraft.
Which one?
Mr. Beecraft. Beecraft.
Wasn't Tommy Cryer acquitted?
It was Tommy, yes. That was the case.
Yeah. Okay.
Judge, and Judge Jones, the restitution order was $55,470.94 as to DeSoto Regional Health Systems. I think that shows, and it just came to mind, how the two cases came together. DeSoto Regional was an essence of this case, and that contract between the parties, that's the basis that the court found, I mean, that the government argued what was owed was they went back to that contract. They kept hammering on the contract. They kept saying this contract was the law of the parties. Under the contract, he should have done this. He didn't do that. And we couldn't talk about that.
She said you're two ships passing in the night because she says that the negotiations had to do with a miscalculation under the contract, and alleged was that there was a whole set of patients who were being taken care of for a cash basis that he didn't even report pursuant to the contract.
But that, I'll pay.
And that's what the judge found. So,
well, we were not able to. I mean, they talked about the contract. We weren't able to get into that. All I can point out is that the release. The parties were trying to settle everything related back to that contract, which was at issue in this case, because, again, that's what the government argued. But we couldn't go into the circumstances surrounding the negotiations with Dr. Miller. With respect to the – I just totally disagree with the government on the marital privilege. The fact that the wife says, you need to pay the taxes, no, I'm not going to do it. And then all of a sudden she becomes a co-conspirator. There was nothing she did in furtherance of the act. The government in its brief says that she committed a different criminal act, so therefore it wasn't admissible. But the court found that the defendant and his wife were joint participants in a criminal activity, that is, tax evasion and or failure to file tax return. If you take, and I wasn't, perhaps it was improper to raise a cumulative effect, I thought, of all these errors in my opening brief. If I was an error in that, I apologize to the court. I was simply trying to point out, as I think I said in my initial brief, this was a perfect storm that created undue prejudice for the defendant. The denial, the allowance of the testimony of his ex-wife, the denial of any testimony about the mediation, those two facts affected both the validity, I mean the strength of the willful blindness instruction, and it also allowed the government to refer to facts in support of its argument against our motion for judgment of acquittal that would not necessarily have been there had the judge ruled the other way. And with all due respect, we would ask the court to either vacate the judgment or reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much.